Psalm 57, the psalmist is taking refuge in God's presence. That becomes obvious, till a calamity passes. It seems he's being falsely accused. That seems to be the problem. Check it for yourself. But he's at peace. He's awaiting the dawn when the judgment will take place. You might know, you might not know, but I'll tell you anyhow. In these little towns, the narrow streets, etc., the only space was in front of the gate of the city. So that was the marketplace, that was the court place, that's where everything was done by the community, because the only place they had, in that piazza, if you want to call it that, near the gate. So if someone was accused of something, they didn't prorogue it, and they didn't have lawyers getting millions of dollars sorting it all out or whatever. They met there and they sorted it out pretty quickly. And if you had two witnesses and you were accused and you got it, you might get killed. There was plenty of killing going on for terrible crimes. Or banished, or you might be... prison wasn't a thing for that. They either got... You got some punishment, whipped or exiled or murdered, punished, killed. Well, he's waiting for the dawn, trusting that God's faithful covenant love will dispel the darkness with the rising of the sun. When the sun arises, and he's keen for the sun to come up because the sun of justice is an image of God, and in the light people will see that he's innocent. And there's a little text here that comes into our gospel. Matthew uses it at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. It's taken from Isaiah chapter 9 after the collapse of the northern kingdom and the Assyrian army, Sargon II or Tiglath-Pileser, whichever of them it was, coming down through that area, and he's talking about the northern part. I'll read it for you. There will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In other words, dreadful things have happened, but he says the light will come. There'll be a time of light. It'll be okay. In the former time, he brought contempt on the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. That's up in northern Galilee. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea. That's Dor, or Duru, as the Assyrians called, near the Mediterranean. The land beyond the Jordan, that's Transjordania, or, you know, over that side, or the Decapolis area. Galilee of the nations. So they're different, they're actually different provinces that Assyria divided that area into. Galilee in Hebrew means territory. And Galilee was well known to be mainly... It wasn't Jewish, of course, because Jews are from Judah. But there were Israelites there, but then after the... It became very cosmopolitan and very pagan, if it's the word, or Gentile country. But in the 2nd century BC, there was a migration of people north from Judah, and Joseph would have been among them, and maybe Joseph was there, it's obviously later, but Joseph was a carpenter, and during Joseph's time, Herod the king was building his capital at Sepphoris. Zippor in Hebrew means bird, and it's up on a hill. Zephor is Zippor. It's got a bird view of the whole of Galilee, really. And Joseph probably went there with his brothers to get work. And Jesus probably worked there, hammering things and building walls and that for the aristocracy. And then he only had to come down the hill and come home, and he brought some bread with him, so that was good, kept things going. So, anyhow, whatever of that, it was a mixed race place. So Jesus was already born in a missionary area. So that might account for his openness to the Gentile world. But that's the text. And when Jesus goes to Galilee in Mark chapter 4, which is the beginning, of course, of the public ministry, that's quoted by Matthew. And Jesus is the answer to the prayer, because he's the light of the nations, the one who's bringing good news, gospel, to the nations, to Galilee, to the territory. And note that the beautifully confident conclusion, which is actually so beautiful that they stole it, and it's the first five verses of Psalm 108. So you'll find it used elsewhere as well. That's not often, but that's the case. We've already seen Psalm 53 and Psalm 14 being the same. Well, Psalm 108 verses 1 to 5 is the same as Psalm 57 verses 7 to 11. A profound trust in the kindness and faithfulness of Yahweh. St. Augustine, he comments on all the Psalms. If you want to read them, if you can read Latin, and you might get an English translation, I'm not sure, sees the Psalms as celebrating the passion of Jesus, And when he comments on verse 7, I'll remind you of it there, he sees Jesus' heart being ready for the suffering of Calvary. So when I keep reflecting on the New Testament, I'm not suggesting the psalmist is foreshadowing anything. I'm just saying, when we read the Old Testament, we've got to read it looking at Jesus, so I'm trying to help you do that. So, be gracious to me, O Yahweh, be gracious to me. For in you, my soul, you'll probably find I've translated, my entire being, everything about me, nephesh, takes refuge. In the shade of your wings, I take refuge until the destructive storms pass by. You might like to think of an eagle protecting its young, and I don't say that's not there, but I think the image is much more likely to be the temple and the Holy of Holies, the Kadosh, the holy place, where they had the Ark of the Covenant, and the hilasterion, it is in Greek, the kippur, the cover, a simple word in Hebrew, which was God's throne, mobile throne, till it was settled in the temple. And then on each end of the throne, a miniature, but they're there, are two cherubim, you know, with the lion and the ox and the eagle, and they're mythical creatures, and they're protecting the temenos, the sacred place, which you find all through Iran and these places, that reality, daring, no one dare enter the sacred place because of these creatures. Well, there's one here and there's one there, and this one here has wings covering his body, two flying and two like that. And so where the two wings cover, when the author says, I want to be in the shade of your wings, he means, I want to be in there, in that sacred place where you are, where I'm safe from everything. Like you might want to be in the tabernacle, you know, with Jesus, kind of thing. So where a place of safety and where no one dare enter. Till the storms of destruction pass by. He's going through a hard time and it's too hard. So I cry to God Most High, to God who fulfills for me his loving designs. That's a lovely line. He's confident that God has designs for him and will fulfill them. Beautiful insight. He sends from heaven to save me, frustrating the desires of those who are hostile to me. And there's a selah. I think it is a pause in the chanting, and there's music, instrumental music, helping you meditate. God sends forth his kindness and his faithfulness. The last letter Paul wrote, if you think Paul wrote the pastoral letters, which I join the minority of scholars in saying I think he did. It's not. Some take it for granted he didn't, and they keep saying it. All I can say is I've got into all the evidence. Yes, I've got into all the evidence. I don't find it convincing. There's no solid reason for doubting that Paul wrote 2 Timothy, in my view. Literary, all the arguments don't satisfy me, so therefore I would rather stay with the tradition. And there are very good reasons for thinking Paul wrote it. In any case, whether he did or didn't, 2 Timothy 2:13, if you want to see all my arguments, you have to read my commentary. But they are there. It's solidly argued, I think. If we are faithless, says Paul, and we can be, he remains faithful. God doesn't react to us, or pay back us, or punish us, or stop things up, because we've mucked things up. God is better than any grandmother, any lover. For all eternity, God loves, because God is love. He cannot deny himself. We can. But God can't. That's beautiful. So whatever you've done, whatever you're doing, whatever I'm doing, whatever I've done, wherever I've been, one thing we're all absolutely certain of is that God loves me. It doesn't mean I'm getting the love. It doesn't mean I'm welcoming it. It doesn't mean it's even helping me, but it's there for me. The sun is shining. I've got the blinds drawn. That's why I'm not getting it. So we've got to pull the blinds back and the sun's there for me. The Father is waiting for the prodigal son. It's the whole gospel. And isn't it terrible when you think of some of the ways that the gospel has been preached that give exactly the opposite and do what our politicians, some of them, are doing now and use fear as an instrument for control? That's a horrendous heresy, to be abhorred, named, and opposed with everything. And the people who support that kind of theology, not surprisingly, are people who lack a lot of love. They're not just intellectually stubborn, they don't seem to have ever been loved or something, in my view, anyhow. Lamentations, if you want to. Lamentations chapter 3 is a wonderful document. If you're feeling crook, no, truly, read it and you'll see, you'll think, God, I'm light-hearted, really. Because this bloke is so worse than you've ever been. He lays it on, he's at the bottom of the pit, and you thought the pit was 10 foot deep, and he's down there in the murk. It's really lousy stuff. You can't go beyond it. It's the most powerful bit of literature I've ever read for bloody awful situation. But it ends like this, after this stuff. This I call to mind, he says, and therefore I have hope. You think, God, where did that come from? You know, this hope. But this is what gives him hope. The steadfast love of Yahweh never ceases. That's what gives him hope. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And then he meditates. So that's come out the end of a massively dreadful passage of pain. Yahweh is my portion. Yahweh is my heritage, you know, says my soul. I might know much else, but I've got Yahweh. Therefore, I will hope in him. Yahweh is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It's good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of Yahweh. I think that's just superb. But you have to read the whole of the third chapter to get it in its beauty, full beauty. Well, here we go to our bloke now. He's pretty grim too. I have to lie down among lions, and he doesn't mean he's in Taronga Park Zoo, that greedily devour human prey. Their teeth are spears and arrows. Their tongue is a sharpened sword. And this will come back later, the refrain. Rise up, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory fill the earth. They set a net for my steps. My whole being was bowed down. They dug a pit into my path, but they fell into it themselves. They stepped back into their own pit because it was covered and they forgot where it was, and they collapsed into where the lion's supposed to be. My heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. He's not waiting for the dawn to wake him. He's going to sing and bring it on. Because when the sun rises, in the light of the sun, of God's sun, he will be seen to be innocent. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing to you among the nations, for your kindness is as high as the heavens. Your faithfulness extends to the clouds. And here's the refrain. Rise up, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory fill the earth. And it might remind you, it certainly reminded me, of the last words of the Benedictus put on the mouth of Zechariah just before the birth of Jesus. John the Baptist is born, he's praising God, and he ends it with saying, by the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us. In the days of Caesar Augustus, you know, in the time of the high priest, he goes straight on to talk about the birth of Jesus. He's the dawn. He's the rising sun that brings light to the world. And we think of the resurrection, of course, of Jesus as well.